So, you know, I just love to be anywhere where people are trying to learn and grow and be part of this world, live out your values. So just so happy to be here with you. I'd love to hear stories of how the pandemic affected you, is affecting you. It certainly is endless, it seems. So one of the surprises, I've been surprised by many things during the pandemic time. And one is that I started running. Couldn't surprise me more. It's like I had time. I just started running. So now I'm a runner. Which is kind of, I know, hard to believe, but it's true. So we what a time we're in where what's around us is shaping us. So as the introduction about me said, I'm a person who's been studying indigenous beliefs now for quite some time, and I've had the opportunity to study with shamans and with people who've studied with shamans, and had the opportunity to travel to Ecuador to work with the Achaks, the bird shamans there in the Andes. And what a gift to continue to unfold this whole way of being on this world. So the shamans, just a little history. Back in the early 1980s, there actually has been for a very long time like a council of indigenous people that meets and shares teachings. And it was in the 1980s that they decided it was probably time to share it. Because obviously they had protected their teachings because, as you can imagine, over the centuries their teachings had been exploited and destroyed. And so indigenous people had gathered it in and kept it very quiet. So that's why in 1980, really no one went to Machu Picchu yet. And now everybody goes to Machu Picchu in Peru in search of these spiritual things. So the shamans decided it was time to start releasing information which caused in our global consciousness such an interest in all of these more ancient ways of believing. So the shamans tell us that one of the reasons they released the teachings is because there was an end of an age coming, according to their prophecies, an age we'd been in for thousands of years, and it's the age of duality. Good, bad, evil, not evil, male, female, all of those opposites, right? Duality. And that we've been struggling with it, living with it now for centuries. So they're saying we're moving into a new time, a new way of being in this world. And we're moving into the age of unity, where those things that we label, like let's just take male and female as an example. In our culture, right, it's all becoming irrelevant in many ways. All of the ways we can call each other or be in this world isn't necessarily this or that. It's this. And that's true with so many things in duality. But the truth is that it takes a while to move that way. They talk about it being an hourglass. So we've been in this age, and now it started in the 1980s, kind of that squishy movement. And then 2012 being sort of what was opening it up again. But, you know, aren't we lucky? We get to live in the little time period where it's so tight and so, you know, we can feel it. Things are changing, but it's slow and it's a little painful too. So we're just beginning to emerge into this whole idea of unity. It calls us to look within, to discover our own obstacles to unity, and the pandemic has given us time to do that, to really start to do that kind of self-examination. So that's all a prelude to thinking about your amazing theme of compassionate action. So long ago when I was in seminary, long, long time ago, they taught us how to put together a sermon. And this is not a sermon, this is a talk. But his sermon would have 3 points, and they taught us how to, you know, get these 3 points, and I spent a lot of time working on 3 points, and you're going to get 3 points today. But it's from that shamanic understanding. They believe there are 3 centers to us. One is our head, our thinking, right? And here in our culture, which they would think of as the Northern Hemisphere, or we might think of as Western thought, we are caught here. This is where we live from. So it's important that we think about stuff together, and that's where we'll start thinking about compassion. Another center is our heart. The shamans in South America would say that that's where they have lived, in the heart, and not always balanced with the head. So as we start to hear their teachings, we start to open those things up. So we'll think about our heart. And the third place they see is our belly, or our core, where our action resides. So as we look at any topic, we want to wash it through our head, our heart, and our core. So those are our 3 steps today. So let's start where we're comfortable, in our heads, which is to think about the word compassion. Compassion defined is simply, according to Webster, a strong feeling of sympathy and sadness for other people's suffering or bad luck, and sometimes our desire to help. So the Latin root for compassion originates in compate, or pate, if I don't know Latin, so I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing it wrong. Pate on compate means to suffer, and the prefix com would mean to suffer with, compate, compassion. Now, in the Hebrew scriptures, the word for compassion is rachamin. And if you were to study the Hebrew scriptures, you would discover that the way we think of love is really more often used with the word compassion. You won't find that word love in the way we think of it. But instead, it's compassion. It's rachamin. And rachamin is derived in Hebrew from the word rachem, which is the word for womb. Now, even if you don't have a womb, you've been in one. The rahim, this place of protection, of being held, of whatever we think of this, and the fact that the Hebrew would use that word, a feminine word even, to talk about compassion, I think is such an interesting way to think of the word, rachamin, the compassion, and how we hold it. So that's our little, then I guess the other part of it is that in the word compassion, that calm prefix coming alongside passion, how do we come alongside our passion to create compassion? What is your passion? Which takes us to the little quote by Ram Dass. It's in your bulletin there if you like to read along. The first one, Ram Dass says, "I would like my life to be a statement of love and compassion, and where it isn't, that's where my work lies." So Ram Dass is saying it's not so much that we work at compassion, but we work at where we're not loving or compassionate. And how do we discover that? So this moves us from our head to our heart. I want to tell you a story. It's a story from when I was in my 20s, and I was a youth director at a church, and we had a large group of us that were all youth directors, everybody kind of doing the same thing in our little network of churches in Grand Rapids. And we would get together to support each other, to kind of share ideas. In the 1980s, being a woman in the church, even as a youth director, was unusual. But I was determined. I could change the world. So away I went. And we had this nice group. It was mostly young men who were all youth directors in churches. And we developed a philosophy that I still hold to this day, which was that we would never ask the youth in our church to do anything we were not willing to do. Don't play a silly game if you're not willing to be silly. You know, don't take them skiing if you're not willing to ski. You know, those kinds of things, like, 'cause you're planning activities all the time for youth groups. So as we tried to hold that value of we're not going to ask them to do anything, we would, as a group, take off on a backpacking trip together so we could experience that and see what it's like just to be a participant. So one day we decided we wanted to try a high ropes course. Have any of you ever done a high ropes course? Did you notice it's high? So if you haven't done one, if you picture a whole stand of trees, tall trees, that if you're walking down on the forest floor, you wouldn't even notice it. You'd have to look up. And there, 30 to 40 feet above you, you would see stretching different ropes between the trees, from one tree, another one from that tree to that tree. And each area had a different kind of challenge, right? And those of you who've done it, you kind of know that. So the first challenge is getting up to the ropes course. There was not an elevator. You climbed up the tree and got there. Now, I'm a farm girl from Wisconsin. I climb silos. I love heights. So this was like my playground, right? And I love trees. So what could be better? So away I went, climb, get on the first platform. You're all harnessed in, so you don't have to worry about my safety, right? I wasn't worried. And when you get to the top, you have a rope, and you clip it onto this thing, a little guide rope that runs between the trees. So whatever thing you're doing to traverse it, you're always hooked in. So if you fall, you just fall. You can pull yourself back up and get back on the ropes course. Now, we had this group of youth directors up in the trees, and down at the base of the trees are the facilitators. And so they're calling up to you some suggestions. You know, they're watching how you're doing and what you're doing, and then they're encouraging you, etc. So I'm pretty happy up there, right? I'm zipping through little stuff, feeling really good, and the director from down below is, well, this time, don't hold on to anything, because usually there's some kind of guide ropes you could be hanging on to. So I'm like, okay. So I try not holding on to anything. You know, I fall, but I can get back up. And it's so much fun. They're calling other things to people like, stop crying. A lot of, you can do it, you know. So I get to the next obstacle. When each time you got to a new tree, you had to unhook and hook onto that tree, and somebody always had to watch you. You had to find somebody who could stop whatever they were doing and take a moment to be sure that you were hooking in correctly. So there was a lot of interaction as you're moving along. So I get to another obstacle, you know, another platform area, and the facilitator says, do this one backwards, which really, it's almost impossible, right? But, you know, I'll try anything. So I'm going backwards, and of course I fall, and you're dangling in your harness till you pull yourself up. And the facilitator says, just stay there, don't get up. And I'm like, well, why not? I'm gonna send someone over to help you. I don't need any help, is what I yell back, because I know how to get up. And he goes, I know, but just hang there. So, you know, I'm listening to the facilitator. I'm just hanging there in the harness. And then the facilitator calls over,
Sherry, I want you to go help Ruth get up.
Now, Sherry is the other girl up there on the ropes course, and she is petrified. And I am fiercely independent, fiercely. It's gotten me a lot of places in life, and it also can cause a lot of pain, right? So I'm dangling there, and I'm thinking, Sherry? So I call down to the facilitator, how about if Matt helps me? He's right there. And the facilitator says, no. So then, you know, I'm just hanging there. And, you know, all kinds of things go through your mind. So then I'm like, well, I'm going to try a different tact. This isn't fair. I paid for this experience. I know. So there I am, dangling. And I'm watching Sherry, who can, you know, who's at least 4 trees away from me, which is a long ways. And I'm just sitting there. And pretty soon, I am just sad, right? I can't be the strong, amazing leader that I just love to be. I'm hanging 30 feet above the ground in a harness. And at that point is when things really change, not in that just that moment, but really in this life. Because I continue to be fiercely independent and prefer to do things on my own, where I realized that the only way I could get back on the course was by encouraging Sherry. So I'm hanging there. I'm like, come on, Sherry, you can do it. And eventually a little more, Sherry, you're doing great. I'm just, you know, Sherry, I'm waiting for you. I need you. I can't do this without you. Come on. Come on. I need you. And Sherry, bless her little heart, finds the strength to keep coming until she's at me, and then we have to get up together. And then I say, and she's just like shaking because it's really frightening for her. And we're both standing on the little rope together, and I say, let's finish this one together. Let's finish this little section together. And we held hands and finished it. So when Ram Dass is saying, where in your life is there not love and compassion? That's where your work is. My work is not being a fiercely independent woman making her way in the world. My work is being vulnerable. It's being accessible to people who I see as different or not as capable. I mean, where did all those judgments come from of poor Sherry, right? It comes from this strong desire that I have to be the strong one. I have to be the competent one. My work lies in vulnerability. And when I can accomplish that, then I learn about compassion. So when we think about that word compassion coming alongside our passions, my passion to be independent, to be strong, come alongside it, and I discover vulnerability. It's like the other side of the coin. If you came next to your passions, whatever they might be, physical, political, whatever it is, whatever ignites you, and come alongside it, I wonder what the other side might be and what work that might give you as you think about compassion. So those are the things that moved me into my heart. But now let's get to that, the third part, that sort of the core, the doing. So let's take a look at the other reading that you have, Alfred Lamott. I won't read the whole thing, but he's a delightful pastor, poet. Just love the way he thinks. So, what is an activist? You can be an activist planting winter squash, walking in a fern forest, listening to your children, or smiling from your heart at someone who is lonely. True activism means to gently immerse your whole astonished body in the river of presence. And then the very last line of it, Earth is not transfigured by how much you do, but by how wantonly, how nakedly you plunge into the ocean of this perishing moment. I just kind of want to sit with that for a moment. True activism is immersing our whole astonished body in the river of presence. You know, we talked about that a bit in the little pre-talk here about, you know, what are the things that keep us from being compassionate? And often, when you're just in the moment, compassion happens. It's when our heads get in the way sometimes, we think a little too much. So when we immerse our whole astonished body into that river of presence, what might happen? I could tell more stories about those things, but it's actually a song that came to me as I was preparing, and I could read it, but I like to sing, so I'll just sing it to you. Because I think it's by Billy Hill, written in 1936, and I think it talks about the kind of action we want and what it means to have compassionate action. You've got to give a little, take a little, let your poor heart break a little, 'cause that's the story of, that's the glory of love. You've got to laugh a little, cry a little, till the clouds roll by a little, 'cause that's the story of, that's the glory of love. You've got to win a little, lose a little, and always have the blues a little, 'cause that's the story of, that's the glory of love. Yeah. So people walking this spiritual path, here is our hope, that we can come alongside our passions, and we can explore where we stumble, and that we can see who is with us on this path in a way that enables us to act passionately, out of strength, out of what we discover on the other side of strength as we move our lives toward compassionate action. So may it be. Thank you.